This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Herding Code. This week we break with tradition and bring on our first guest, Rob Connery. And so, Rob, do you want to introduce yourself or do you want me to make something up?
I like it when you make things up.
Okay. I wasn't ready. You called my bluff. Okay. Rob, would you please introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Rob Connery, and I work at Microsoft. I've been working there for the last 7 months. I've been told that if I introduce myself that way, I engender a lot of good feelings and trust in people. So that's the way I do it now. I've been developing for the last long time. Let's see, how many years? About 14, 15 years now. And currently, I'm working a lot with the ASP.NET MVC team. I don't work on the ASP.NET team. I actually work in a little ninja group inside of Microsoft. Seriously, a lot of little ninjas. And it's called the Agility Group, and I work for Sean Burke. And he's the guy that runs, or used to run, I should say, the ASP.NET AJAX control toolkit. So there you are.
Well, I'm sure we'll want to go back to some of the more current stuff, but a lot of people know you because of Subsonic.
Mm-hmm.
So one exciting piece of news is Subsonic 2.0, or 2.1, excuse me, that just came out.
Yeah.
Run down any of the new exciting things? I know Substage is pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, really, it should be a full point release. We waited, almost close to a year now before we released 2.1. It's been in the planning stage and just kind of glomming stuff on. And I was just laughing with Eric that, you know, we were ready to release it way back in, late winter. Because, you know, it's just a bunch of bug fixes. We wanted to do a point rev there. But I was getting so much heat from all over the place, started by Phil Hack, with respect to how our query tool worked. And people didn't like the, you know, uppercase select and this and that, and yada, yada. So there's a lot of changes I wanted to make anyway. So over Christmas vacation, I prototyped out an API and I showed it to Eric. And, you know, it came together really well. And so what came of that was a whole mess of work. And eventually we rewrote the whole core of server tools and things that we do. And so it was all good stuff. So yeah, we have a brand new query tool, which is pretty much the major bit in there. And then a whole slew of bug fixes based around transactions and multiple providers. And we've added support for SQL CE and Vista. And what else? Eric made up a really cool kind of IDE sort of thing he's calling Substage. That's pretty much covers it. We have a lot of things in there.
I guess for people that aren't familiar with it, can you give us the elevator speech? Like, what is Subsonic? And I know it's tricky because it's a lot of things. But
yeah, it's the grease for the squeaky wheels, you know, pretty much. When we were introduced to .NET years ago, there was just all of a sudden an explosion of code and properties and dot this and dot that and methods this that you needed to know. You needed to know the API in order to do anything. And I remember it took me a full 6 hours to get data from a database onto a page. That was my sort of my test to see if I could use this thing. Whereas I always used to classic ASP, you know, not RS.EOF, blah, you know, and there you are. So, you know, there's a lot of simplicity that was lost there. And, you know, and there's a lot of things you gained, like, well, manage code and so on. But as time went on, I kept feeling like, you know, are they ever going to kind of get Zen on this and make it really simple? And it's always seemed like the framework just kind of went out, you know, and big and out and big. And I started using Rails just for fun because a friend told me about it. And as I started using it, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, this is just so easy. I can actually focus on things that matter to the application. And I thought, man, I need the simplicity in life. And so at the time I was working on the Commerce Starter Kit and I just started using that as like a little bit of a sandbox. And next thing you know, I popped out with this tool. And the thing for me that was really cool was I was reading a Fritz Onion blog entry about the build provider and how to use it to output classes and so on the fly. And it blew me away that you could do that. You could use the build provider to write imaginary code. And so I just put it all together one night, and I still remember jumping up out of my chair, screaming at the top of my lungs, waking my daughter up in the next room, and my wife running in, and I'm like, I just, yoo-hoo, got this thing to work. And
you don't
magic.
Understand. It's a build provider.
The short of it is, I mean, developing in .NET's tough, and it's good that it's tough because it allows you to do tough things. The problem is that sometimes the simple stuff gets lost. So there it is.
So when you left Microsoft to form Telligent, what were you thinking?
I was thinking, you know, I just had enough of this. After I invented ASP, I was thinking, what's, you know, I need a new thing. And so I decided to take that .txt guy and put him in a bookshelf and see if we could invent some really crazy software. And it worked out.
Awesome. So yeah. Where do you see Community Server going in the future?
I think,
you know, I've thought for a while we have too many Scots on this show, and
oh wait, different Rob.
I could do a good Rob Howard impression. Wait a minute. Never mind. That's just horrible. You know, actually, I worked with Telligent for a while. I love those guys. I was on contract to Microsoft before I came on full time. And pretty much the only way you can get a contract with Microsoft is to go through a company that provides services to them that already has a contract as a vendor. And so I knew the guys at Telligent, and I begged them, and they took me on as, you know, kind of facilitating the invoicing. And during that time, I got to know Scott and Rob and Jason Alexander. I got to know those guys really well, and I have to say that's a good group of people over there. I told them I was going to rewrite the forums, though, and they didn't like that.
So we've had a couple of discussions related to the dynamic data and the entity framework and subsonic in the past. And yes. It seems like Microsoft is going in four or five different directions. And you've kind of talked about this on your blog. But, you know, I thought it'd be better to get it from the Hawaiian's mouth.
Oh, boy. Yeah, you know, I was going to say, I like you guys' podcast. I listened to the first 4 minutes of one once, and then I think I threw my headset across the... No, I'm just kidding. that's a good question. So let me tell you the particularly strange position I'm in at Microsoft. So I was literally hired by Scott Guthrie, or recruited by Scott Guthrie, to come in and sort of work on Subsonic. That was his vision, and I thought it was pretty cool at the time. And I still do. The problem is, when I got in there and I saw the projects that were in the works, I remember asking specifically my boss, I said, Sean Burke, I said, there's a lot of parallel paths here. And the conflict that I'm in is not only, if I duplicate this, people are going to wonder why I'm duplicating efforts going on and then putting it out in an open source project. You know, see, you know, there's a problem there. And there's not a legal problem. It's just the PMs would kind of be cranky with me. So it'd look like I'm taking trade secrets and so on. Or whatever you want to call it. But then not only that, but things like the scaffold, which I'd been working on, which has a parallel-ish effort with dynamic data, I'm sort of all of a sudden stuck. And so the interesting thing that came out of it was I sat down with Scott Hunter and the guys who were doing, which was at the time called Oryx and Dynamic Data, and I really tried to dive into it with them and see what was going on. And the interesting thing that came out of it was, well, they looked a lot at this at the scaffold, and we realized they're talking about a project foundation, which is what dynamic data is. The scaffold was just seriously like me binging one night while coding. I had a beer in my hand, and I said, I got to make an editor. And I did. And it turned out to be sort of the trademark Subsonic tool set, you know, the scaffold thing. I'm trying to make sure I stay on the question so you don't think I'm evading. What I decided to do after all those things happened, I decided to wait. I needed those guys to clarify their direction because at the time that I was hired, it wasn't exactly clear what they were doing, and they're kind of modifying and moving along. I needed them to clarify what they're doing, and then what I always have always said and always maintained from the very beginning with Subsonic is I build on top of what Microsoft does. I am not competing with them. So that's kind of where I'm headed now, and that's what I'm still doing. I'm sitting and waiting in the wings while MVC matures and dynamic data matures and they put it out. And then I can fill in the gaps because that's where my strength has always been. And I'm not necessarily an innovator per se. I just make things a little bit more sweeter. Is that a good answer to your question?
Yes. Yeah, that helps clarify the position a lot. And you know, Microsoft gets a rap for, you know, not invented here syndrome and lots of duplication of effort, especially around their developer tools. But mostly as it relates to the OSS community, you know, why do we need another dependency injection or, you know, object container when we already have 9? Well, you know, what's 10 if we have 9 already?
That's a good question. Well, you know, the interesting thing that's happening too, which I haven't really talked about much, because it could get me in trouble, but since you guys are you guys, and I know it's just us in this room and no one else is listening, the interesting discussions I've been having lately, people send me little emails and say, you know, it would really be cool if Subsonic would do XYZ from within the company. And it, like, it could play well with what I'm doing here. And I'm finding that ideas and features, let's say, of things that either have been axed or cut, people are approaching me with. And I think it's really cool. You know, it's kind of become a little bit of a spot where people can throw ideas. And that's always sort of been the goal of it. So, anyway.
Cool. Okay, Scott, I think you had a question.
Hey, Rob, I've really enjoyed your MVC storefront series and the screencasts that go along with it.
Wait, I have to give you a big fat hug. Can I virtual hug? Can I send a little teddy bear emote to you? I read your blog post and I finally sat down to fix Lazy List. And
awesome.
It works. It works great. I'm so excited. You don't understand how excited I am. Can I
That's
scream?
Good.
John, you have to edit it out if I scream.
No, go ahead. I'll put a big echo on it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to say thank you. So go ahead.
Oh, sure, sure. But so throughout that series, you've been using Link to SQL a lot, and I just wondered how you compare and contrast Subsonic and Link to SQL and what you found particularly difficult or easy with Link to SQL.
In a single sentence, Link to SQL uses a framework construct that is really, I won't say orthogonal, but it's really, how do I put this right? The link syntax is made to obviously query anything that's IEnumerable, IQueryable, whatever. You can do a lot of gymnastics with that in code. Translating that into SQL is weird. It just is. And I'm looking at it from two angles. From enabling it on Subsonic, where I have to translate these link expressions that come in. But then also from the other angle, where I have to guess what the developer will translate my link statement into. You know what I'm saying? So if I'm sitting here thinking to myself, how do I write a delete query with an in statement on it? That's not easy, you know, against Link to SQL. So it's been tough to try and to figure out the translations, because when you're writing an e-commerce store, you're starting to get into some technology and some features that are pretty gnarly. And it pushes you really quickly to the outer 90-10, let's call it, where you're trying to solve some problems. And it's really tempting to just say, oh, screw it, I'm going to do a view or a stored procedure. And I can't. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's good.
But with Subsonic, I mean, the nice thing is they're both query tools. I have to say, of course, I like the API with Subsonic a lot better because I can think in database terms, as opposed to what Jeff Atwood likes to think is just object noise. I think, you know, when I created that API, I think in select from blah, blah, you know, and I kind of know where I'm going with the joins. And with Link to SQL, I find it to be a lot more guesswork until, of course, you know it, and then it's just another API.
Right.
So I got two things. First of all, Jeff, who? Secondly, do you think that most of the impedance comes from translating an object-oriented language like C# and the .NET framework to more of a functional language like T-SQL?
Let's see how to answer this. It's actually three things. So you start with an object-oriented language, and then you move into this like recursive nested expression tree sort of thing. It's like a blob. SQL is pretty direct, and yeah, it's functional, like you're saying. But you have three things you got to work with. You have to translate, you know, the translation between kind of an object-oriented thinking when you're typing the code and you type in these link expressions. You're thinking in an object-oriented sort of situation. That gets translated into this expression tree, which is really nutso, kind of this recursive nutso weirdness. I'm gonna trademark that term. Tell me if I'm getting too technical for you guys.
No, but that's
great. Well, then it's got to go into it's got to be translated into SQL. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's an impedance mismatch. It's more like it's more like just a different mindset. You have to shift and think in all three ways if you really want to do it right. To give you an example, like the example I was talking about where you're trying to delete items. Let's say you have all these product items for a given order, and you want to delete using an in statement, let's just say. That's just not easy to do with Link to SQL. But if you sit back and you think, well, I'm gonna try and put myself in the seat of the developer who's developing these expressions. How would they do it? And then you can kind of start thinking through the expression tree. Oh, it's probably like this. And then boom, you got it. So it's pretty tough.
I think the official Microsoft terminology is BAM now.
BAM. Yeah, actually, we need to get that. If you can just say it once, and then we'll splice it in the audio.
BAM?
Perfect. Okay. So, you know, while you're talking about expression trees, I know that you've been working really hard on Link to Subsonic, and you've mm-hmm. told me several times that it's very difficult to really get into the whole nested expression trees and work as a provider. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Oh, man, it's one of those things that it's always a challenge to try and explain. Recursive tree sets, I've never been able to do it for some reason. The deal with expression trees is you start with a basic expression of a given type, and then it could be a method call, it could be binary, a Boolean, member, access, a constant. It could be any of those things. And inside that expression, it can contain more and more. And that's why they call it a tree. So you start at the very tip top of the tree and you work your way down. And then you just have these branching, and more branching things. The only way that you can really write a reliable SQL statement is to do a visitor pattern on it, which is to go walk every single node. And each previous node gives context to the next. Let's say you start with the very top, which is a method call expression. And inside that method call expression, you might have a binary with a left and a right. And inside there, you'd have another binary that's a left and a right, but the left and the right is a constant and then a member access. So long and short of it is you have to walk and tiptoe down each one of those. And it's really, when you're doing a recursive system, you're kind of having to do this visitor pattern that appends values as you go along. So you're knitting together these statements. That works fine if you're using a string builder. So, you know, if you can imagine putting a star on top of a Christmas tree and then kicking the tree, and the star starts falling down the branches, and whatever it pings off of it might say, select from table name, and then where, and then it, you know, it builds it as it goes. So the long and short of it is, Subsonic's not built that way. Subsonic's a very kind of, as we talked about before, object-oriented thing where you add a where into a where collection, and then, you know, we parse it based on when it went in and so on. You can't do that with this thing, you know, because you can't look that far ahead to figure out when that constraint is going to be finished building.
Yeah. Well, I had one question that a listener sent in. This is from Dirk Devrient, and he asked, I'm going to summarize it, but he basically said, okay, you wrote this a recent blog post about writing decoupled testable code, and yes. And he was saying, that's great, but why isn't that the default way of doing things?
It's an interesting position that you're in when you provide tools like this to people. A lot of people claim, oh my gosh, it makes you write bad stuff. Like with the active record pattern we used before, people would accuse me a lot of, you know, saying, hey man, you know, you're pushing people to put this stuff in the UI. You're kind of facilitating bad code. And my approach is always like, I'm not going to tell you how to program. That's up to you to learn. You know, you don't rely on my framework to make you a better coder. I will save you time, but your architecture is up to you.
Right.
And so I don't know if that's a cop-out or not, but in a sense, to get back to the question that Dirk asked, all I'm providing is data access. I can't crawl into your application and sort of intuit what higher level model you want to work with, let's say. So that blog post I wrote was working with a detached model that's not part of your database. In Microsoft land, that's not really, you know, given Link to SQL and a lot of other ways, you know, with data sets and all that other stuff, your data is pushed really high into the application stack. And so we're really used to having data right there. But in kind of the alt.net realm and other worlds like decoupled code world, you don't do it that way. You work a lot with interfaces and you work with a model that doesn't really care about what the data looks like. So in that sense, it doesn't matter what your data access is. What matters is your architecture that is able to abstract it out. So in a sense, to directly answer that question, there's nothing I can do to make your model more object-oriented and to separate it from the database. I can't intuit that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, really all you deliver the power and then people decide use the power for good or evil. But it is it is a good question.
Hey, Rob.
Hi, Kevin.
So as part of your MVC storefront series, you've been sort of trying to do it all sort of test-driven style. And I kind of got the sense that you were not totally sold on test-driven development when you started this process. And I'd be curious to see whether that has changed over the course of this and whether you're more into it. Have you been sold on it or are you still skeptical?
Completely. Absolutely, completely.
You've bought into the fad?
Yeah, it's funny. I always used to tease Phil. I teased Phil constantly that it was a fad. He hated it. You know, so there's two things I'm eating my hat on, and I have a whole presentation that I'm going to do on eating my hat, which is great because, you know, when you eat your hat, you've learned something. And I can't walk away from this without saying I didn't learn anything. TDD rocks. TDD absolutely rocks because I just refactored a whole mess of stuff here, which I'm readying up for the next screencast, where I literally ripped the shopping cart completely out of the application in favor of using an order instead of, you know, whatever. Point being, I ripped it out and I just spent an hour going back and making sure all the tests passed. And when it passed, my application worked. And I was like, that's just covering yourself like that is beautiful. The second part of this is truly learning from guys like Allende how to do decoupled coding, and Steve Harmon too, and Aaron Jensen, and all those guys kind of sat with me on this. Truly writing decoupled code is not, you know, because I used to tease people before. I'm like, great, so you've done it, so now you can hang a certificate on your wall, like, I write decoupled code, whoopee. You know, what does that get you? Does it really serve your application and your client? That was always my point of view before. But now as I'm moving through this, and I'm having clients who still call me from 5 years ago to fix something on. I just had a client call me because the tax service that we're using on one of their commerce sites just went out of business. So I have to rewrite now a whole section of the website just because the tax service went down. And I was thinking, wow, if you've been around this business for a while and you're good and you have those long-term clients that you're servicing, you owe it to yourself, your five-year from now self, to write code that you just easily unplug and plug back in. Had I done that, I'd be a really happy man right now, but instead I have to go in and do this work. So those are the two things that I'm very grateful for.
I mean, I was just curious how Rob would compare his experience with ASP.NET. Does he think it's better for his scenario? Is it going to be workable when it ships?
Oh my God. You've asked the buzz question. It's funny. Let me see how I can answer this. We had an internal meeting. And when I say internal, it was just people that I work with just talking. It was me, Stephen Walter, Scott Hanselman, and I think Phil. And I won't say who it was, but a person was writing up a blog post about when you should use web forms versus MVC and which is better. And I said, please don't ever answer that question, because if you do, you will be in big trouble by one side or the other. So truthfully, everyone's got their opinions, and I can say what I enjoy working with, which I think is what your question was, but I want to make sure, and it's super clear, that I can't take sides on it, because, I mean, you know, I have my opinions. I love working with MVC. I love the simplicity of it, specifically because the UI is so much easier to work with for me. I like having extension methods and helpers. I love having a clean page that I can look at instantly and understand. Because if you write a good view page with good helpers and extension methods, you instantly know within seconds of reading it where things are. And you don't repeat yourself. And to me, I could never quite look at a repeater and understand what that thing was doing in terms of what information it was repeating on the page. So I really enjoy working with MVC. However, I will say, I've talked to others like my boss today who just don't think that way. And he was working on an application and he said he gave up because working with web forms was easier for him. And that's pretty much what it comes down to for everybody.
Yeah, so you think that you see the choice between ASP.NET, web forms, and MVC is that'll have to be made based on your philosophy and personal preferences instead of necessarily your application that you build, right?
Yeah, definitely. And see, that even in itself is it's almost like an unanswerable question, because if you come out and say, well, you know, use whatever makes you feel better, and you'd have the alt.net guys in one corner throwing things at you because, you know, you're not writing testable code and you're not serving the greater good of ASP.NET. And I mean that with all good due respect. But then on the other side, you have the guys who just want to drag and drop, get it done. I got a prototype to write, get out of my hair. And don't tell me which I need to do. I have business to attend to here. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yep. So what's going to be the bigger debate, C# versus Visual Basic or Web Forms versus MVC?
Well, I'm happy to announce that VisualBasic.net is being discontinued. I'm totally kidding. well I am done. Not a VB guy, so I don't really speak about that language.
so going back to the web forms versus MVC, because it seems like an uncomfortable topic for you. So would it be a better decision rather than making people decide between web forms and MVC to maybe retool web forms to make it suck less in certain areas where it's less gooder than MVC, let's say.
Oh boy. I mean, really what it boils down to is MVC goes along with a lot of philosophy and approach to coding. I think it's totally possible to write testable, good websites using web forms. There's a lot of things you can do. I don't think it's going to be as testable and modular as MVC, to be honest with you. So it really, if you're talking about someone adopting MVC, let's just take someone at Company X, you kind of have to talk with Company X about their approach to development and how you do certain things. Like the iterative storytelling approach is sort of an agile way of doing things really fits well with MVC. Testing code and so on really fits well. So it depends what the company's into, if that makes sense. Did I answer your question?
Mostly. But I don't know that you can necessarily answer it. I think that's the answer's going to have to come from the DevDiv and the UX team at Microsoft in the next 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
I've kind of asked Phil and I've asked Brad these questions before in little community events. You know, what is the ASP.NET and MVC future for the next 5 to 7 years out? You know, will web forms still be hanging around, or will it be as, you know, derided as ASP, classic ASP is now? Will people be looking to port their web forms code to some version or derivative of MVC, or will they be working in straight pipes? You know, no one's going to be doing any kind of HTML junk rigmarole. They're just going to be sending data straight over the pipes to rich clients or to Adobe Air apps or things like that.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing too, for sure.
Pipes is the future. So, Kevin, say something smart.
So, Rob, to me, one of the really interesting things about the MVC project is not just the technology, but the way it's been developed. It's been a real break from how traditionally Microsoft has developed and delivered software. Mm-hmm. Be interested to hear your perspective on that and sort of how that came about and what was the real driver for that?
Well, it was literally Scott Guthrie on a plane to a presentation geeking out, you know? I think because that guy, as we all understand, is a nutcase. He doesn't sleep and he gets these wild hairs going, and he just does something and he gets inspired. I don't know what caused him to. I have a feeling he was just kind of watching what was going on with Rails and the other frameworks like Django and so on. I don't know. This is my guess. And he just sat down in a plane and said, I think I can do this with ASP. And so he started it. And then he threw it at Elon and said, Elon, make it work and make it look pretty. And so he did. And then it just went from there. And Phil, I don't know this for sure, but I generally credit Phil for the push for CodePlex, although I know Scott was very open to that as well, and being really transparent about it. And I know all the guys, it's really funny, all the guys in DevDiv really are digging this. From just the talking to people internally, you know, sure, you have a few folks in there that are not very happy being, because, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into this stuff. And when I say they're not happy being this open, it's because sometimes when you're that open, things get slowed down and you know, it's really hard to deal with.
They may get slowed down in the short term, but like, say, you know, Entity Framework probably had some great velocity, and then, you know, last year when they announced it, then they kind of hit a wall a little bit with customer acceptance. So I think you make your trade-off at one point or another.
Yeah, and with a framework like this, and, you know, you bring guys on, like, you know, Phil and Scott and myself, who are really into kind of open source stuff, and we each have open source projects. I mean, you know, by default, we're very community facing. And, you know, each of us, as time has gone on, have really pushed the openness aspect of it. You know, we're constantly kind of pushing the envelope. And everybody in DevDiv, seriously, well, in our group, I should say, is really responsive to it. And the question overall, Scott Hanselman hit on in his last blog post about making MVC work ASP 2.0. He had to work with legal services. And normally that's not greeted very happily internally because you have to go, you know, talk to a lawyer. But their attitude was very much, how can we make this work? Rather than the thousand ways it can't work. I have to say, I'm really surprised at that. And especially when I sat down with those guys and I said, you know, because they said, we need a sample application. I said, great. I want to blog every step of the way. And I want to do a TDD. I want to da da da. And they just said, that's an outstanding idea. And I was just like, are you kidding? So it was awesome. And I, you know, you want to point to Scott as the guy who facilitates that because he is the ringleader. But he generally, he's the guy that kind of pushes that. And I would say, if you're asking why that is, it's all him.
So do you see this approach spreading like a virus through the organization? Are we going to see more of this out of other projects at Microsoft?
It depends how well it works. And right now it's working really well. I think the positive feedback from all our kind of outward initiatives, like what I'm doing, what Scott Hanselman's doing with Baby Smash, the way we're doing this on CodePlex, Iron Ruby's up at RubyForge, those kinds of things are engendering good feelings. So yeah, you know, hopefully they're going to keep moving with it. I mean, I love it. I think it's great. And every single day that I talk to my boss every single week and I hit him with three or four ideas of things. And, you know, it's got to the point where he listens. He's like, oh man, you know, one thing at a time, let's make this work. Let's make this work. But I'm right behind you. Let's do all this stuff. So I think they're going to keep moving that way.
So Rob, what's next? What do you have in store for us next?
Let's see. So Silverlight, the Silverlight controls and a large chunk of Silverlight, not sure exactly how much, has just transitioned to my boss, Sean. And our internal group has moved over to working more with Silverlight. So
I'm sorry, but Rob, can you clarify that a little bit? You're saying that the entire Silverlight controls or externals, you know, like in the way of ASP.NET AJAX controls or the whole Silverlight control stuff?
You know, I'm being completely honest with you right now. I don't know. This just happened recently, you know, and Sean called me up and he's like, hey, I just want to let you know we're realigning a little bit. And this happens all the time. People move groups around and, you know, shake it up. So Sean took on a big chunk of Silverlight. That's the way he phrased it to me. I didn't ask specifically. But what we're working on is just adding some control features and so on. And I don't honestly know how much I can say about it, truthfully, because I don't know enough about what we're doing, and I could go off and say something that's not true, and I don't want to do that. But I will be working a lot with Silverlight. We're going to work with integrating Silverlight into the storefront, so that's coming in a bit too. And I don't know where it's going to take me, but I definitely want to use the store. I want to keep going with the storefront as far as I possibly can take it. I'd love to layer on some Silverlight, as I was mentioning, and other things. But what's next is pretty much that. Silverlight, yep.
So I was going to kind of revisit the general way that MVC has been developed as more of an open, let's not say open source, but more open project, you know, putting up source code on CodePlex, Hanselman and you being able to blog everything. So to take kind of the contrary or the Debbie Downer viewpoint, could it just be that Microsoft just doesn't care because these projects aren't that important? I mean, you know, Hanselman's kind of put out there that MVC is going to be for maybe 5% of the people that use Microsoft development tools. So maybe they're like, yeah, you know, do whatever. Sure. Yeah, whatever. We you know, just we'll put you back on a real project when this little thing is all done.
I wouldn't say that it's not that people don't care. It's just, I mean, right now they're just facing the truth of it, which is it is small. You know, it's important to remember too that the AJAX control toolkit went up on CodePlex, and I think it had the same sort of momentum behind it. In that, yeah, there's AJAX, and it's really easy to use on ASP.NET. Oh, by the way, here's a whole big mess of tools that you can use with it. With respect to MVC and, you know, the love it's being given, you know, I saw the team when it started out, which was one Elon, and then, you know, Phil was taken on, and now they've got a whole mess of guys, and they're still moving on it, and it's still growing. So I wouldn't say that Microsoft doesn't care about it. It's definitely receiving a lot of good feedback, for sure. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. That was kind of a devil's advocate kind of approach, but you know, it does sometimes get downplayed as, you know, well, this, you know, web forms lighter. This is for a small vocal minority and not for the rest of the people.
I'll touch briefly on that point just for a second because I think it's important. All of us that are working on it, and again, I am not on the MVC team and I'm not on the ASP team, but I'm kind of working in sort of a satellite position, you know, helping them out. Anybody that's involved with MVC, generally speaking, I mean, people ask all the time, you know, is this the new web forms? And should I transition to this? And it's really hard to answer that. You can't. You know, I mean, in one way, yeah, there's a lot of great strides being taken to putting together a really ripping framework and very testable framework. And you know, you want to take pride in it and say, wow, this thing is awesome. But the minute you say that, it's yin yang, you know, you lift up one and the other one kind of goes down. And so people want to pounce on that and say, which way is it going? Which way is it going? And truthfully, honestly, 100%, the answer is, well, no one knows. It depends on what people are enjoying and it depends what, you know, because WebForms has what, 5 years behind it now, right? 2000, so 4 years, 5 years. 2002?
WebForms? Well, yeah, it was about 8 years, really.
Yeah, it was being developed way before 2000. Back when it was called ASP Plus and...
Oh, yeah, AWS, okay.
And all that.
That's right. Well, anyway, so I'm not... I guess what I'm trying to say here is there is no Uber mind at work that's making a decision. Everyone's just looking to see how it plays out and see if the uptake is. I mean, it could end up being ASP.bob. You never know.
So I have a follow-up question about the ASP.NET and MVC team. What's Phil Hack really like?
He's Phil of the Shire. He That's a reference to Phil's height, by the way.
Well done.
He called me a giant one day, and I said, you're just short. I'm not tall. Now, Phil is a ball of energy, nonstop, positive, good energy guy. I don't think you could have a better friend, and he's a really nice person. And even when he's super stressed out, I swear, you know, I'll call him up and say, do you have a second? Sure, you know, and he might be typing away and looking off in the distance and answering phone calls while I'm talking to him, completely ignoring me, but at least he's got a smile on his face. You know, he's a good guy to work with. I've never seen him get ruffled, really. Why do you ask?
So we're really short on time, I think.
Okay.
And we've got all night, but we want to keep you out of trouble.
Sure.
With the desecration of date night. So, yes. So I'm just wondering if we have any last questions for you.
So related to World of Warcraft, I just got IM'd by a prominent Microsoft program manager, who said he was having an argument in a World of Warcraft chat channel about comic books, and I was wondering if you thought that was quite possibly the nerdiest thing you'd ever heard in your life.
Okay, I was telling John, John and I were rapping about this before. When I joined Microsoft, there's a lot of internal distribution lists. I mean, the company's got 80,000 people, so there's, as you can imagine, every kind of distribution list that you can join if you want to. And so I'm an avid World of Warcraft player. I wonder how many people are playing, and sure enough, there's thousands and thousands of people. And in fact, for all you Warcrafties out there, there are a number of Microsoft guilds, groups within the game that play together. So I joined one of them, thought it would be fun. And yeah, the chat channels are hysterical, because the guilds are all nerdy computer science, like the one I'm in is just called Void. And
Rob, when you were saying that there are lots of groups and stuff, I was hoping they were more like 12-step programs. But you're saying these are actually for people that want to continue in this. Is there help for these people?
Oh, no. There is no help for it. I mean, you know, if you have that kind of problem, you're out in the street. No, I'm just kidding. Well, yeah, so in the game, though, it's funny because, you know, there all these characters' names. There's a guy named Kerberos, and you know, it goes on and on. So it's pretty funny when you're running around in the game and you have these characters. But the chat channel is hysterical because people.
Does the Vista character get its ass kicked just like every day?
Oh my gosh, that's great! I got to create a character that does just that.
Maybe you can make a Windows ME that's like a first level dwarf or a gnome or whatever the tiniest thing in there is, and just have him trip a lot over his own feet.
That's great. Oh, too funny. It's entertaining to say the least. Especially, you know, because normally when you're playing the game, there's these, you know, 15-year-olds that love to play and just act like idiots. But you get on the chat channels with these guys that are, you know, it's like talking to you guys. You know, it's kind of funny. And in the context of the game, people drop stuff like that all the time.
If you make a Vista character, you have to make an NVIDIA character that just goes over and, like, whacks the Vista guy in the head 5 times an hour.
I got ganked by NVIDIA. Ah!
Yep.
Too funny.
Great. Well, Rob, thanks a bunch for being on the show. And would you be interested in showing up again, or have we sufficiently pissed you off and you'll never talk to us again?
No, this was fun. This is fun. I have to practice. I have to practice not putting my foot in my mouth. So you know, you guys ask some good tough questions, and
you're not going to fit in if you don't put your foot in your mouth.
Oh man! So check it out. I'll tell you one last real quick story. At Mix, I was on a panel with all these open source people, and I was with Sam Ramji and Miguel de Acasa and Mike Schrepfer from Mozilla Foundation. I mean, some big name, Andy Goodmans from Zend, the co-creator of PHP. Like big names. And then there's me, you know, woohoo. And so it was Larrabee, asked what we thought about the Yahoo deal. So I'm not going to repeat what I said, but I just said what I felt because that's what I do. And later on, I come to find out that I didn't get it. Seriously, I didn't get the email, but we were asked not to comment on it because it's going, you know, it was hot and heavily. It could happen. And there's press there. And so they just said, please try and not answer any questions because the press could construe your statement. And I froze. I was like, that's my job. I'm done. There it is. Stick my foot in my mouth in a big way. So that was pretty good. But no, I didn't get any trouble. In fact, my boss laughed at me. He's like, yeah, you pretty much got to work on that a little bit.
And you got the memo now that the answer to any Yahoo question is just the standard yodel. Yes.
Exactly.
Great.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate talking to you.
Yep. Thanks a bunch. That wraps up episode 9. We'll catch you guys next week.